Well, comrades, we are living in the most turbulent and convulsive period possibly in the whole of history on a world scale, certainly since the Second World War. And the dramatic events which have shaken the world and which are still unfolding on the streets of Tehran and other cities of Iran are a graphic demonstration of this fact. The movement in Iran, which we have described as a revolution, and I will justify that statement in a moment, these events, as far as most people were concerned, seem to fall like a thunderbolt from a clear blue sky. I've never been to Iran, but I imagine that they have very clear blue skies over the city of Tehran. And in this country, this great country, by the way, it's a great country, it's a great nation with a great culture, and a marvelous history, which has been systematically demonized by the West as a bunch of crazy fanatics, Islamic madmen and so on and so forth, want to bomb the world into annihilation with nuclear weapons. Incidentally, the United States, of course, has got the biggest stockpile of nuclear and chemical and bacteriological weapons in the world. That's okay. It's not okay for the Iranians. And Iran, that's the only image that's ever put forward for this great people, this great nation, this very courageous nation, by the West, by the hypocritical so-called democracies of the West, it's painted in this particular way. And therefore, most people would have been taken completely by surprise. They were taken by surprise. Not just in the West, by the way. The Iranian regime was taken by surprise. They shouldn't have been taken by surprise, but they clearly were. The American imperialists were taken by surprise. Incidentally, here's a little question for you. Here's a little riddle for you. The same imperialists in Washington and London who for decades have been systematically denouncing Iran, these crazy people, this terrible nation. And now there's this revolutionary movement. All of a sudden, they become very timid in their criticism. You don't see them. They haven't even supported the movement, as a matter of fact. They kept their mouth well and truly shut. And the reason why they keep their mouth shut, now Obama's made a few timid statements, but that's nothing. I think the only European head of state that has criticised the election is Dr. Sarkozy, for his own reasons. None of the others, Gordon Brown, they're all being very responsible and very... Now, why is this? And the reason is, as a matter of fact, the intelligent capitalists, the intelligent reactionaries, very often will reach similar conclusions to the Marxists, of course, from their own class point of view. And they're not interested in it. They don't want this movement. They certainly don't want the revolutionary overthrow of this regime from below. Why not? Because it is dangerous to them and their interests, particularly in this part of the world, which is a strategic part of the world, from the standpoint of imperialism, for different points of view. And what more strategic country can there be than Iran, which straddles two continents, which has got different, even in its own frontiers, it's got different people. In a sense, it's part of the Middle East, although it's not an Arab country. It's also part of Central Asia, historically. It's got strong historical links with Afghanistan, which is a key country, with Pakistan, which is on its borders, even with the southern part of what used to be the Soviet Union, Turkey. All next door to this country. And the last thing that the imperialists want is instability, as they would put it, anarchy in Iran. Especially because, and we predicted this in an article which I wrote in January at the time of the Gaza attack, the Gaza invasion. At this point in time, every single one of the pro-Western regimes, the pro-imperialist regimes, by the way, they're very selective in their defense of democracy. Yeah, they attack the Iranians, okay. They don't see them attack dictatorial regimes like Egypt or Saudi Arabia or Jordan or Morocco. They're quiet about that. That's okay. because they're pro-imperialists. And the fact of the matter is that these regimes, most of them, are hanging by a thread because of the world economic crisis, because of the falling living standards of the masses. It's not reported in the press. They report all kinds of rubbish. Even on a serious channel like Channel 4, they report all kinds of nonsense and rubbish. When did they ever report the fact that there's been big strikes in Iran in the last period? Who knows about that? Nobody knows about it. And big strikes in Egypt in the last period, and big anti-regime demonstrations in Egypt. They don't like to report these things. And therefore, just imagine, if there's a revolution in Iran and it overthrows this regime from below, what's going to happen within a matter of weeks in Egypt, where Mubarak is hanging, as I say, by the tail, or Saudi Arabia? They're all trembling in their shoes. That's why. All of a sudden, these nice foreign democrats are kept very quiet about this, being very reasoned about it. This movement appeared, as I say, apparently from nowhere, but that's not the case. As a matter of fact, if you can check our website, you can check Marxist.com, you'll find for the 10 years ago we predicted this. And I personally have repeatedly predicted this movement. Even last summer at the international gathering of the International Marxist Tennis, I specifically made that point. Watch Iran, keep your eyes on Iran. And now it's suddenly emerged. Incidentally, they falsify history. Because even 30 years ago, if the truth were to be told, there was a revolution in Iran against a pro-Western tyrant, the Shah of Iran, who was an agent. By the way, the British and Americans overthrew a democratic government in Iran in 1953, the government of Mossadegh, which was a bourgeois democratic government, a genuinely elected government. They overthrew it. And these same ladies and gentlemen, these same Western hypocrites, now got the cheek to lecture the people of Iran on the subject of democracy. What stinking hypocrisy. How can that be taken seriously? They overthrew Mossadegh and they replaced it because of oil. Because they wanted to grab the oil wealth of Iran. It's an important factor in the equation. They replaced him with this monster, the Shah of Iran, who was a terrible, one of the bloodiest tyrants you could imagine, one of the most horrific regimes of repression you could imagine. With his secret police, the Sarak, murdering, torturing, the most bestial tortures and so on, spying on people. That's the regime that the West installed in Iran. That's the benefits of Western democracy that the people of Iran enjoyed. And in 1979, despite what is said, it was a mass movement very similar to what's taking place now, on an even bigger scale. The overthrew of the Shah, it was a tremendous thing. Very courageous people, the people of Iran. Very courageous people who stood up to this tyrant, and although they were killed, they were massacred, they were tortured, and so on. You know, they stood their ground. And eventually, by the way, through the intervention of the Iranian working class, which is one of the most powerful working classes in the whole region, along with the working class of Egypt, it was a general strike, a strike particularly the oil workers, that finished the Shah, and that's got an important lesson for the present movement. Unfortunately, for certain reasons that I haven't got time to go into, it's partly due to the wrong policies of the workers' parties, particularly the Communist Party, the Tudeh Party. Unfortunately, this marvelous movement was hijacked by the mullahs, by Khomeini, who had nothing to do with it. He was sitting in Paris. He had nothing to do with this movement in Iran, and the whole thing was diverted along the most reactionary lines. And we have to be clear upon this point. There is nothing whatsoever progressive about the present regime in Iran, although they call themselves revolutionary. Well, the Pope calls himself a Christian, so what? You know, some of the Labour Party leaders call themselves socialists, so what? Brezhnev called himself a communist, so what? Doesn't matter what you call yourself. It's quite amusing, if it wasn't so serious, these Basajis, these so-called revolutionary guards, which they've unleashed like mad dogs against the population, are counter-revolutionary guards. It's the opposite. It's a counter-revolutionary regime. These are counter-revolutionary guards, lumpen proletarians, thugs of this horrific regime. But you see, but 30 years have passed. 30 years have passed, and the people of Iran have had 30 years' experience of this fundamentalist, reactionary mullah regime. Incidentally, irony of ironies, one of the main rallying calls of the revolution of 1979 was to denounce the Shah's regime, that it was not just pro-Western, not just reactionary, but it was corrupt. They were completely corrupt, it's true. The Shah was completely corrupt. Disgusting, obscene wealth, alongside the most terrible poverty in what should be a prosperous country, like all the countries who possess oil in that region. Yes, the Shah was corrupt. And the mullahs, Khomeini and so on, they said, oh no, we are clean, Mr. Clean. Khomeini was Mr. Clean. They were supposed to be not corrupt. Well, you know, experience tells us that any totalitarian regime, any authoritarian dictatorship is always corrupt. And a dictatorship composed of mullahs in white robes or grey robes, whatever colour it is no different. They are just as corrupt, if not more corrupt, and everybody knows it. The man in the street and the woman in the street knows this. These mullahs are filling their pockets, that they're just as bad as anybody else. This is a useless regime. It's an anti-popular regime. People know this. After 30 years, the people of Iran, most of them anyway, are up to here with the mullahs. Fed up, especially the youth and the women, who of course have been turned into the marvellous women of Iran, who've shown their courage now, coming onto the streets. And that's one of the most interesting things about the last week. It's very unusual to see men and women on the streets, no question, no discrimination, fighting together. The women of Iran have stood up and said, we've had enough of this, had enough of being treated as second-class citizens in our own land. And the youth of Iran is tired of all the petty restrictions and all kinds of nonsense that these mullahs have put across. They're tired of this after 30 years. And here's an interesting point, if you didn't know it. 70% of the population of this gigantic country, I think the population is 70 million, isn't it, Anna? I think it's 70 million. It's a very big country anyway. 70% of this gigantic country are under 30 years of age. Therefore, they've never known any other regime than this. They've never known any other life, and they are fed up to here with it. If you add to that, you add to this enormous accumulation, 30 years of frustration, of despair, of discontent, which has accumulated under the surface for three decades, if you add to that the economic crisis, the crisis of world capitalism, which has hit Iran as it's hit every other country, with the falling price of oil, I think it's rallied a bit lately, but that doesn't matter. They've not got the same, the mullahs and Ahmadinejad have not got the same room to maneuver that they had previously. Although it's true that the press has pointed out, I think it's fair to say that Ahmadinejad still has some points of support, mainly in the rural areas, among the backward peasantry, strongly under the influence of religion, and he's given certain concessions on the basis of oil wealth. They could afford that. They gave certain reforms to the poorest section. They have some support, it is true. But that's finished. As a matter of fact, no matter who wins this particular struggle, whatever government is in Tehran, they will have to carry out a policy of cuts and austerity like every other government in the capitalist world, because the capitalist crisis will force them to do so. But the economic crisis has also had an effect among the middle class, the workers, of course. Well, there's one little detail. I noticed this 10 years ago when the students began to move. There was a student movement 10 years ago in Iran. I wrote articles at the time, which you can read on the website. You can read what I wrote. And the main article was entitled First Shots of the Iranian Revolution. In other words, I described that. That was an anticipation. I stated that at the time. Because the students, Trotsky explains this very brilliantly, the students and the intellectuals are not able to play an independent role in society. That's quite clear. They haven't got the necessary weight to do this. But the students in the intelligentsia are an accurate barometer. They're a faithful barometer of the tensions and the contradictions that are building up within the bowels of society. And they can react before other classes. They've already said they move fast. It's happened historically on many occasions. It happened in Russia in 1900, 1901 to 1903, where there were big student demonstrations, and the students in Tsarist Russia were from rich families, and from middle class and bourgeois families. Those student demonstrations in Russia were an anticipation of the working class revolution, the first revolution that took place starting in January 1905. Same thing in Spain. 1930-1931, there were big student demonstrations again from bourgeois families, but Trotsky said that's a symptom which shows the way things are developing. 10 years ago you had the beginnings of this rumblings in society. They put that movement down fairly quickly by the most brutal means, beating up students, torturing them, some of them were killed, imprisoned, and so on and so forth. And it seemed that that was finished, but we predicted at that time that that was an anticipation of a major explosion that was going to take place. Now what you've seen in the last week is precisely the explosion which we predicted 10 years ago. And we repeated that point in the recent period. Of course, you know, there are some people, astonishingly, some clever people, intellectuals, bourgeois, even some people that like to call themselves Marxists. They don't really like to accept a revolution when they see it. They don't like it. They prefer to deny its existence. It reminds you of something that Trotsky wrote about the Mensheviks, the right wing of the Russian Social Democratic Movement. He said, well, the Mensheviks, they're like a tired old schoolmaster that stands in front of his students year in, year out, every day, every week, describing the spring. Defining what the spring consists of. Then one day he opens the window and he sees the sun is shining, the birds are singing, the fresh air is coming in, and he slams the window shut because this is a terrible, monstrous aberration of nature. These gentlemen don't know what a revolution is. Let me tell you what a revolution is. Let's describe it in terms much better than what I could describe it. This is from Trotsky's great masterpiece, The History of the Russian Revolution, where he says the following in the preface to Volume 1. He actually asks the question, which people don't tend to ask, what is a revolution? What is it? And he answers in the following sense. The most indubitable feature of a revolution is the direct interference of the masses in historical events. In ordinary times, the state, be it monarchical or democratic, or I could add mullah, elevates itself above the nation, and history is made of specialists in that line of business. Kings, ministers, bureaucrats, parliamentarians, journalists, don't we know it? But at those crucial moments when the old order becomes no longer endurable to the masses, they break over the barriers, excluding them from the political arena, sweep aside their traditional representatives, and create, by their own interference, the initial groundwork for a new regime. Whether this is good or bad, we leave to the judgment of moralists. We ourselves will take the facts as they are given by the objective course of development. I think that is an extraordinary definition, and describes precisely what is taking place. Now, you see, it's quite a curious turn of affairs, because it is clear that Khamenei and Ahmadinejad obviously thought that everything was nicely tied up. They must have been quite confident to call an election. I mean, there had been elections before, but this time they even encouraged some elements of debate. There was a debate on television between the candidates and so on and so forth. In the past, people of the Iranians didn't bother with these elections because elections in Iran didn't solve anything. Nobody was interested in these elections. But this time it was different. Because of the accumulation of discontent, of frustration, anger within the population, they were looking for a point of expression, and they found it in this election. To the astonishment of everybody, they were massed towards the end of the campaign. Not at the beginning there was the same indifference, but then it changed. The mood of the people changes very quickly in a revolutionary situation. The mood will change and the ideas will change very quickly. Towards the end of the campaign there were mass rallies, unprecedented rallies in Tehran, unprecedented rallies, particularly around Mousavi, this chap. Now Hegel, marvelous, profound philosopher, once said he said many profound things, but one of the most brilliant things that he said, necessity expresses itself through accident. In other words, you can have the build-up, where you have a build-up of enormous, massive discontent, which is not evident on the surface. This, everything is peaceful, everything is calm, that's what the mullahs thought, everything is nicely tied up. But this enormous seething discontent is building up. It is seeking a way out, and it will find a way out. It can find a way out in the most peculiar ways. for example, for the campaign around Mousavi. Now, Mousavi is an accidental thing. He's an historical accident, to use a dialectical expression. Mousavi is not a genuine opposition. He's certainly not a revolutionary. He was part of the regime. Good heavens, he was the prime minister, I think, during the war between Iran and Iraq. Well, 1 million Iranians lost their lives, by the way. A war provoked by imperialism. At that time, they were supporting Saddam Hussein against Iran, because Iran was seen as the main enemy. They supported and they armed and they instigated that war, which is a criminal war, which 1 million Iranians lost their lives. I think similar amount of Iraqis lost their lives in this terrible war. I believe that Mousavi was the prime minister at that time, so he's not a left-wing. And therefore, here's an interesting question. You see, the regime, Khamenei and co, could have avoided all this mess quite easily. All they would have to do is to shift from the right boot to the left boot. Why not give the results to Mousavi, who probably won? I mean, nobody knows. It's impossible to assess what the result was, but it seems more than likely that he was cheated of the result. Why didn't they hand power to... This is an interesting... Why didn't they give power to Mousavi? He's not a danger. He's part of the regime. Good heavens, he's the same as the other gangsters. Just one more. He just looks a bit nicer, a bit more presentable for CNN television. But he's got the same interests. He's got the same background. He's got the same ideology. Why didn't they accept this? The answer you'll find in history. Now, here's an interesting point. Again, people say it's not a revolution. You know, Lenin explained that there are four conditions for a revolution. And curiously enough, here's a paradox. Every revolution in history does not start on the bottom of society. It starts at the top. The first symptom of a revolution is this, that there are splits in the regime, that there are internal divisions in the crisis of the old regime, which is unable to continue to dominate with the previous methods that it did in the past. You always get this at the beginning of... You had it in France before 1789. There's the beginnings of splits opened up. Different factions are formed. And by the way, they're always the same factions. History repeats itself. History does repeat itself. It's astonishing. Even in details, it repeats itself. The factions are always the same. There is one faction on the top that says, look, we've got to reform, because they feel the ground is shaking under their feet. They have more information than we have. They know what the score is. We've got to reform from the top in order to prevent a revolution from below. That's one faction. The other faction says, no. If we start reforming from the top, then there will be a revolution under. No change. Always the same two factions. One says, if we don't reform, there'll be a revolution. The other says, if we do reform, there'll be a revolution. And you know what? Both of them are right. Both are correct. Because no matter what they do, once the regime reaches that impasse, they are finished. They can cling to power, it's true. And it may well be that the present round, it is like a war, there are different battles. It may be that the present round of protests is going to finish. I don't know, we'll have to follow it. It's possible. We will deal with that question in a moment. But it doesn't matter. The longer they cling to power, the greater will be the explosion when it finally emerges. Particularly when the working class begins to intervene, which it undoubtedly will intervene. Now, of course, the regime was startled by this movement. They obviously rigged the election results, because, to look no further, Ahmadinejad announced the result immediately. He had the result immediately, within an hour or so. Now, look, Iran is a big country, and it's mainly a rural country with quite a backward infrastructure. Even in a country like Britain, it takes a while for election results to get through. In Iran, it would take days for these results to emerge, and yet he announced it immediately. And he announced a landslide. I mean, if he'd been a bit cleverer, he'd say, well, we won by a little bit. You know? A little bit of rigging is okay. What's a bit of rigging between pals, you know? But to announce a landslide, and immediately, but people appalled, particularly because the participation in this election was very high. It was a record participation, which all the political analysts stated would help Mousavi and would harm Ahmadinejad. So understood it clearly. It was not just rigging, it was blatant rigging. It was blatant rigging. Actually, The Economist, this week's Economist, actually, there's an article on that, they actually say, this is not just, this action of the regime was not just pernicious, it was stupid. Which is even worse. I mean, I remember there's a famous statement by a French diplomat, and I can't remember the name of the chap or the incident, but he commented on something indignant. He said, c'est pire sans crime, c'est pire qu'un crime, c'est un erreur. It's worse than a crime, it's a mistake. So that was the sin. Is this worse than a crime? It was a mistake. They blatantly falsified the results, and the result was, as you saw, people immediately came onto the street, immediately, starting on Saturday. Mainly students, young people like yourself. And by the way, it takes some guts in a place like Iran, you better believe it, for students to come on the streets and face death, imprisonment, torture. I mean, we complain about the good old British bobbies. Give this chap a bit of a shove and poor chap had a heart attack and he died. This was a big scandal. Good God, that's gentlemanly behaviour compared to the situation in Iran. No, this is serious business. They immediately came on the streets and confronted the police. There was violence, there was smashed windows of banks, burnt vehicles. They fought with the police, which takes some guts. And the thing began to snowball. I think the authorities must have thought, oh, well, there'll just be an immediate reaction and that's it. No. When the situation reflects an enormous accumulation of discontent and frustration which is built up over 30 years, it's not going to be contained. Once it starts, it's not so easy to contain. The last time, 10 years ago, it took them a couple of days, I think, of repression, brutal repression against the students, and that was it. Not this time. The students started it, but then other people came out on the streets. Ordinary Iranian citizens. Who are these people? Let's just describe. Let's just give the description given by the Economist of this week. In the three decades since the Islamic Republic was founded, Iran has not been rocked like this. Unprecedented. It's a fact. Tehran is engulfed in huge marches every day. Women in chadors, you know, the veil of chador, headgear. Bus conductors, shopkeepers, and even turban clerics, it's a fact, have joined the joyous show of people power. Nationwide strikes are planned. In other words, you get what you have here is that the masses are coming onto the streets. And every day, Khamenei, by the way, Khamenei, the supreme leader, capital S, capital L, the supreme leader. He's not just the supreme spiritual leader. He's not just a religious, he's not like the Archbishop of Canterbury, you know. This man has got real power. He's in charge of the state. He's the head, he's the commander-in-chief of the army. He's the head of the judiciary. This is the supreme leader. Incidentally, Khamenei, in the past, never would have intervened. Now that tells you the desperation of the regime. Khamenei, as the supreme leader, was above everything. He was the representative of God on earth, I suppose, or the prophet or whatever. Wouldn't intervene. He immediately came out on Saturday and said, no, this election result is okay. Ahmadinejad won. And told people to stay off the streets. People did not stay on the streets. Then on Monday he said, if you come on the streets, I warn you, the police are armed with real bullets and they will use them. This was stated on Monday. And he said the same thing every day. Every day he's warned people to stay off the streets or be killed. And every day more and more and more people came onto the streets. That's striking. It means that after 30 years people are beginning to lose their fear. And what about Mousavi? What about this so-called reformer? Every day Mousavi said, no, the demonstration's cancelled. Nobody go out on the streets, stay at home. I want to protect your lives. Every day Mousavi said that. And every day more and more and more of people that are supposed to be his supporters came onto the streets in defiance of it. Didn't matter what they were saying. Oh, no. We heard these reports, but it wasn't Mousavi. It was somebody else imitating his voice. They were determined to protest, and protest they did. They were faced with the formidable apparatus of repression with the police. And there was some interesting reports, particularly by a journalist that I don't like many journalists. I think most of them are crooks. Well, I'm a member of the National Union Journalists myself, I hasten to add, but in any case, a lot of them are a little bit less than honest. Let me just rectify that in case somebody reports me to my union. But there is one British journalist I have infinite respect for. I think he's a very honest man that gives very decent reports, particularly in the Middle East, and that's Robert Fisk of The Independent. You know, he's normally pretty good. And Fisk went on these demonstrations, although he was banned, they were not supposed to do that. He reported them, he gave eyewitnesses, excellent eyewitnesses, marvelous. I recommend anyone to read these reports. I quoted them extensively in my articles. And Fisk describes one incident which he witnessed himself. This flood of demonstrators who nobody had called. I mean, if ever there was a case for anarchism, this is it. You know, this is it. There was no reason there. They just turned up using the benefits of modern technology of which I know nothing. Heiko's the expert, I know nothing. You know, I can't even send a text message to this day, Heiko, you know that. I'm hopeless at that. But these, of course, young kids, like in all countries now, they know all about things like mobile phones and blogging. I don't know what a blog is either, you must forgive me. No, and twittering, I've got even less idea what twittering is. I thought it was the noise the little birds made when I was a young chap. You know, twittering must be something to do with the internet, I suppose. Anyway, they know all this, and therefore, armed with these mechanisms, they were able to self-convene these demonstrations. There's nothing the authorities could do. They tried everything. They tried to close things down. I suppose they got ways and means of controlling and closing these things down and so on. But of course, the young kids are not stupid, and they've also got ways and means of getting around and so on. The clever people like Manuel and Nicholas here, they understand these things. And therefore, they called their own demonstrations. This flood of people, this human flood that nobody could control or stop or prevent. Fisk describes them pouring down the avenues and the side streets towards the centre of Iran, towards what is called Revolution Square, in Klad, isn't it? Same in Turkey, isn't it? In Klad. Revolution Square. Of course, they met with the police. And here's an interesting scene which is precisely, it could have been taken out of Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution, but there's a similar incident. The people confronted the police and just ignored them. Out of the way. As the people poured past the police lines, Fisk noticed that more than one and more than two and more than one young policeman smiled timidly, embarrassed, smiled and nodded, as if to say, "We're with you, well, don't worry." You know. Now, if you read the history of the Russian Revolution, there's a famous incident in the February Revolution, the first revolution of 1917. Where the workers and the demonstrators confront the Cossacks, who are the extreme, most reactionary, most repressive layer of the army. And they confront the lines of the Cossacks, who are mounted on horses with sabres and guns and so on and so forth. And one of the Cossacks winked at the Marxists. Trotsky made a big thing of that. He said, this one gesture, this one wink by this Cossack, it conveyed something. It conveyed something important, and the Russian demonstrators went under the bellies of the Cossacks' forces and got through the lines in that way. So here you have striking similarities. And what that shows in Iran is that this frightful apparatus of repression, well, I don't wish to exaggerate, what you can say is that under the pressure of the mass movement, at least hairline cracks were beginning to appear. And that must have put the fear of God into Khamenei, who, by the way, on the Saturday he said, "No, everything's okay, the result is correct." On Monday he said, no, we'll have a recount, or a partial recount. That already tells you the effect that this movement was having. The splits that are opening up in the regime. Now, you can say, and some people have said, well, you know, it's not really a revolution, because it's very confused, and working class is not leading it, and where's the Revolutionary Party, and where's the Bolshevik Party, and so on. This is a very doctrinaire, very formalistic conception of what a revolution is. And Trotsky explains what a revolution is. Incidentally, the characteristics that you see in the Iranian Revolution, and I will use that expression, the Iranian Revolution, the characteristics which you see is what you see in every revolution at the beginning. You saw it in February 1917, you saw it in April 1931 in Spain. Of course the masses are confused. It's a heterogeneous movement to begin with. It always is. It always is. It takes time and experience for the masses to begin to draw all the necessary lessons. Don't just get that like that, especially where there is no Bolshevik party. And even in Russia, don't forget, the Bolsheviks were a small minority in February. 8,000 in a country of 150 million. That's a small minority. Of course, it's a heterogeneous movement at the beginning. Of course, there are all kinds of confused ideas. But it's through experience that people begin to learn. And by God, they're learning. One of the you see, this movement, we must be balanced about this. It has got its strong points. It's got its strong side. It also has got its weak side. Paradoxically, the absence of leadership is both its strong side and its weak side at the same time. Why is it a strong side? Well, it's a strong side because how the hell do you control something like that? The mullahs came out, the government came out with the usual accusation. Ah, yes, this is a movement organized by American imperialism. This is America. This is the hand of America is behind this, which is a complete lie. The CIA is organizing this, although, of course, the Americans for decades have been there. Drawing up plans to overthrow the Iranian regime. Of course they have. But it's very interesting, precisely at this time they're keeping it very quiet. They don't want to be don't want it to be overthrown in this way. It doesn't suit their plans in the slightest degree. So they make this scandalous accusation that they are imperialists and that there's an organizing center. An organizing center. See, organizing. Now, if there was an organizing center, rest assured they'd be in jail by now. The Iranian state, the secret police are quite efficient. They take no from the Shah. The Shah's time, they got all the methods and so on. The whole point is that there is no organizing center. That's why they can't stop it. You see, there's a reason why the capitalist class normally prefers a bourgeois democratic regime, because it's more efficient, it's more economical. And it allows them certain levers whereby they can control the masses. They've got the trade union leaders, they've got the Labour Party leaders, they've got all kinds of mechanisms that they can use very efficiently to control the movement within certain limits. In a totalitarian or authoritarian regime, you don't have these instruments. There are no free trade unions in Iran, there are no free political parties in Iran. And Mousavi has not been able to play that role. It is like a car without brakes. They can't control, they can't stop this movement. That's the big, the only one weapon which they've got is repression. But that, of course, is very dangerous in a situation as you have at the present time in Iraq. Now, they've tried repression. They unleashed the so-called Revolutionary Guard, the Basij, against the students in particular. Burst into the student dormitory 1 week ago, or last Monday, I think it was. They beat people up, they killed people. Yes, but by this time, the rage of the masses was such that instead of intimidating people, on last Monday, there was actually a report that the demonstrators attacked the headquarters of the Basij, which is unprecedented. The Basij, of course, had guns. The masses had not got guns. They opened fire, they killed some people. Eight people, I think, were killed. And an unknown number wounded. But none of these acts of repression have stopped this magnificent movement. It's a tremendous state of affairs. That's the point. Therefore, the regime, when they saw that the repression was not working, they resorted to other means. They offered this concession, so-called concession, of a recount, a partial recount, which, of course, did not solve anything. On the contrary. On the contrary, then, by this time, you see, when the masses are on the street, they feel their power, the power of numbers, the cohesion of the masses on the street, the fact that they're able to defy even the dreaded secret police and the state in general. They lose their fear, and furthermore, they begin to become bolder and put even more advanced demands. It was, in my opinion, what is the The idea which is taking place on the street at the moment is no longer, it's not certainly not a recount, that's out. Not interested in a recount. I don't believe that the majority of them are even interested in new elections. They are putting forward other demands, particularly the demand death to the dictator. That means the supreme leader. It means Khamenei. This is a direct challenge to the regime itself. In other words, what is crystallized among the masses is a revolutionary aspiration to overthrow this regime. And therefore all the concessions and so on, they don't make any effect whatsoever. Now the question is, what is going to happen? You know the old question, what happens when the irresistible force meets the immovable object? What happens? Well, you know what happens, there's an explosion. The movement is a colossal power, but unfortunately, as I say, it also has weaknesses. It has one particular weakness. Because in 1979, what determined the overthrow of the Shah was the working class, actually, the eruption of the working class, who incidentally even set up Soviets. You know what Soviet, what the word Soviet means in the Russian language? It means workers' councils, elected councils, action committees, if you like. In the Iranian language, I think they call Shuras. The Shura, which was set up by workers in many factories all over Iran. Our slogan would be, our proposition would be, first of all, yes, we stand for all the democratic demands, we fight for democratic rights. That would be the minimum program. We would agree with the demonstrators on that. But we would point out that the only way in a situation like Iran that you can succeed in this is by overthrowing the regime. And the only power in Iran which is capable of doing this is the working class. Through suras, through a general strike, which in a situation like Iran must pose the question of a nationwide insurrection on the lines of 1979. Is this impossible? Not at all. The idea of a general strike has already been raised. Even Basavi's hinted it in a vague way, that if I'm arrested, perhaps there could be a general strike, things of this character. But nobody's organized a general strike. What is necessary is you'd have to put a date on it. Such and such a date, everybody out, everybody stop. This call has not come forward, except for vague references. Nobody's called for a strike, and yet strikes could still break out. The situation is still very fluid. I mean, there's all kinds of repression is brutal repression is taking place. They even had the disgusting policy in the last few days of saying to the relatives of people that have been shot dead, people that have been killed, the corpses are in the morgues, or that you have to pay money in order to get the bodies back. This kind of insult, gratuitous insult towards people. It's terrible. And at any stage, some kind of a massacre could take place and the whole thing could go up. Let me just quote from a recent, I think it's a blog, I'm not quite sure, something on internet anyway. The mood is tense. This is from yesterday. And the environment for strikes is actually there. There's a lot of talk about it. Everyone is discussing the possibility of strikes, but so far nobody has gone on strikes. The banks are open for business. All the stores and the bazaars were open. And here you see the decisive role of leadership. There, incidentally, for your information, there has been a general strike in one part of Iran. I think it was on Tuesday, wasn't it, Jordan? In Kurdistan. The Kurds have gone on strike. There are different nationalities in Afghanistan. Here's the report from the Green Brief. Quote, there were sporadic reports of a more successful strike in parts of the Kurdish-inhabited areas of northwestern Iran. In Kurdistan province, the cities of Sanandaj and Sekes were reported to have had half their shops closed. In other words, the basis for a general strike is there. Yes, but if nobody calls this strike, and Mousavi, for all the words, is not prepared, because he's more frightened of the mass movement probably than the regime itself, then of course it may or may not take place. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, what is the perspective for the movement now? Now, I would say that certainly the colossal energy, courage, dynamism of this movement is self-evident. Last weekend, by the way, on Friday, after they tried everything, finally the supreme leader, Khamenei, gave a warning on television. It was in a mosque, but it bust in, obviously, about 100,000 people, big deal, to cause the maximum impact. He warned that this time they meant business, that this had to stop. If it didn't stop, then they could expect the worst. Despite that, the last weekend there was still demonstrations. There were still demonstrations. There was repression. The police turned out, beating people, shooting at people. The people fought back. And on more than one occasion, they forced the police to run for their lives. In other words, the movement is still continuing. It hasn't yet run out of steam. It may have some way to go yet. It might even end up in a general strike. That is possible. But I would say this. You mustn't be too sure about that perspective. Because it is clear that the movement cannot continue to go on as it has done for the last 10 days, something like this. Since the election, it can't continue like this. People cannot constantly be on the streets demonstrating. It's not conceivable. I would say this, unless this marvelous movement reaches a critical point where it goes onto a higher level, which could only be a general strike, I'm afraid that this movement could eventually begin to decline. You can predict that. It simply isn't possible to continue just to go when people don't see any perspective, any possible result. And the authorities now seem to have got their nerves back. They're putting the boot in, they're repressing hard, very hard. And therefore it is possible, it's not certain, there's all kinds of situations so unstable, but it is possible, they might manage to control the situation and the movement could go down. Now is this the end of the world? I know some people raise their eyebrows, but I wrote an article saying Iran, the revolution has begun. But you have to understand, a revolution is not a drama of one act. It can run for some time. The Spanish Revolution, for example, in the 1930s, started with the downfall of the monarchy. By the way, as a result of local elections in April 1931. And lasted, really speaking, until May 1937, the May Days in Barcelona. That was the last real opportunity that the workers had to take power in Spain. And within that period, a seven-year period, and it's a revolution that lasted for 7 years, there were all kinds of developments. There was periods of enormous advance. The masses were on the streets in April 1931. But there was also periods of defeats, like the defeat of the Asturian Commune in October 1934, which ushered in a period of 2 years of brutal reaction, called the Bienio Negro, the two black years, which in turn ended up with the Popular Front government, the Civil War, and a new chapter of the revolution. In other words, what I'm saying to you is, when I wrote that the revolution in Iran had begun, I'm underlining the word begun. It's begun, yes, it's not finished. The first act of this great drama may be coming to a close. We're not certain about that. Maybe coming to a close. But this will go on, it will continue. With all kinds of, there can be all kinds of developments, governments can rise and governments can fall. There probably, almost certainly, will be a period of bourgeois democracy in Iran. Until finally the masses, above all the working class, draw the necessary conclusion that the only way to save our people, the only way out of this mess, is that the workers must take power into their own hands. Now, I'll finish just with one reflection. These are dramatic events that are unfolding before our eyes. You have to understand the scope of these events. In a key country, absolutely key country, it's a key country for the imperialists and it's a key country for us also. Because just imagine the effect of a triumphant revolution in Iran. Incidentally, if you ask me, all right, they overthrow the mullahs, and what will then emerge? What will be the nature of the regime? The answer is, I don't know exactly what kind of regime. There could be different possibilities. I don't know. But I do know one thing. I know there's one kind of regime which is completely ruled out. And that's an Islamic fundamentalist regime. That's finished. That's finished in Iran. The people won't tolerate that anymore. Although they will remain Islamic, they will not reject Islam, naturally. But they will never again tolerate a tyranny of fundamentalists as they had for the last 30 years. That being the case, just imagine the effects in the neighbouring countries, where you've had this plague of Islamic fundamentalism for a long time now. The effect in Egypt, the effect in Afghanistan, the effect in Algeria, the effect throughout the whole area, the effect in Pakistan. It is an astonishing perspective that opens up. And it's a perspective, I will just finish on this note, which proves what? Well, the first thing that it proves, it exposes all the nonsense of all the cowards and skeptics and renegades that wrote off revolution, that wrote off the working class, that said it wasn't possible for these people. It has been shown to be false. What Iran shows is that the revolution will come back, and it will come back, and it will come back all the time, until eventually the people, the working people, have conquered the type of society that they, in their hearts, they are seeking. The Iranian revolution is not just any revolution, it is the key, first of all, to the Middle East. It is the key to Afghanistan, it is the key to Pakistan. It is the key, if it had a correct leadership, a Marxist leadership, a genuine socialist leadership, it could be the key to the entire world. That's the importance of the Iranian revolution. I will just finish by saying, it's our duty, it's your duty and my duty, to provide the maximum support to this family, this marvelous family, to support these courageous people, support the students that are risking their lives in the streets of Tehran and other cities. Support the workers that are on strike. We have a solidarity campaign, it's been running for some years now, which supports, with some effect, has been supporting the Iranian working class in struggle. I appeal to you, first of all, to think about what has happened, to learn about Iran, to follow the events day by day. I hope that you will follow them through our website. I think we do quite a good job in that respect. And above all, the best way I think that we can help our brothers and sisters in Iran is by developing the movement for socialism, the fight for freedom, the fight for genuine democracy, for workers' democracy in Britain, in Europe, and the entire world.